Welcome to QuakeCast, the podcast for id Software's classic Quake and the games it inspired.
Hello, Quakers, and welcome to the QuakeCast. JCR here, filling in for RC, who is off saving Earth from an asteroid today. Today, we're speaking with Lunarin, who is longtime mapper and modder in the Quake community, and we'll be discussing his latest release.
Yeah, it's a mod called Copper, and it's a single-player enhancement for Quake. It sounds simple, and it's deceptively complex. So we'll take a deep dive on that mod and a whole lot more. He's been around the Quake community forever, so here we go. Here's Lunarin.
I got interested in mapping when I was in grade school. Like when Doom came out, I remember my father downloaded one of the original Doom level editors and printed out the entire manual on a really long scroll of dot matrix paper. And I wound up reading the whole thing thinking that it was just the coolest thing. Cause I was already a kid that played with Legos and I can do that with a computer too. Cool. So I wound up screwing around with that, making maps in what seemed like at the time, the most intuitive way for a kid to start getting into level design is just you draw the map in the editor the same way you draw it on a piece of paper. You just sketch the walls out and they turn into rooms and you can walk around in them. It's like a perfect little hitch for your imagination. So from there, the tech grew up as I grew up, and I just sort of kept jumping from one id game to the next until, the present era. I missed the first wave of Quake, because the first Quake editor I downloaded was, I think, Thread. And it was just very, very hard to use. And the things that were hard to use about it, I thought were things that were hard about the actual Quake mapping paradigm. Like, it didn't let you change the texture on a surface unless you carved it. You had to take a brush of a different texture and carve off the face to put a new face there that had that texture on it. I'm like, that's impossible. How do you even make stairs? I don't even want to do this. And I just went back to Doom for another 2 or 3 years. It was like a year and a half between Quake and Quake 2, I think. 2 years? Something like that. So then Quake 2 came out. And Robert Duffy started working on the Quakehead code and he turned it into QE Radiant. And I gave that a try and thought, wow, this is so much more sensible than what I thought it was. I've been missing out on this. And it was QBoard back then. Headshot's little secret message board for multiplayer designers to actually talk about level design, which was a thing that no one on the web had really done before. And I lurked there for a while and then eventually made an account because I really wanted to be like those guys. And from there, it was off to the races.
I don't want to talk about Quakehead yet, but I'm going to get there eventually. From dabbling in Doom, you kind of moved on to Quake 2, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yeah.
So content creation for Quake 2. So mostly multiplayer stuff, right? I mean, you've been kind of, for quite a while, you had been focused on multiplayer design.
Yeah, I started out focusing on multiplayer. I think it was mainly because the influence of QBoard was they were very multiplayer centric. And also it seemed like a simpler kind of design. Like you just build a small coherent space with one purpose and it's easier to pull off. Like it was less of a challenge for me. So I remember at the time I eventually even started writing like blog articles about multiplayer design. I didn't even play multiplayer. Like, I don't know who I thought I was as a teenager. It was like, I'm going to describe the things that these other guys are doing when I never actually tried playing multiplayer online. I just made little circular spaces and thought that they were pretty good.
And I want to just jump in there and say your blog goes back to 99. So you like, and it's, I'm sure there's a wealth of design information on there.
Yeah. There's a wealth of like teenage anger and general poisonousness that I had to grow out of, but you can see that as an arc instead.
You ended up at Raven, and so you definitely spent a portion of your life in the professional area. So how did that come about?
I had started art school. You can get pause for laughter in 2001, and by my sophomore year, I had already made some cool Quake 3 maps. And so they were emailing me saying, hey, we're staffing up for Quake 4. Are you interested? And I'm like, yes. But because at the time I listened to people who I took the word of people who I shouldn't have taken the word of. And I decided to finish school instead of just going straight into working professionally. And if there's anybody listening to the Dump Truck podcast right now, who's in art school, who's debating whether or not they should leave and go apply their skills professionally right away, if you have the opportunity, take it. Cause listen to Uncle Lunar, and I've been there. If, as hard as it sounds, to want to be able to put the words art school dropout on your resume. It sounds more like a roast, but on the general ladder of having your shit together, it still puts you above art school graduate.
I can vouch for that as an art school dropout.
Good. You see, you are JCR is above me on the ladder, so you are destined for greater things than I.
I wouldn't go that far, but yeah, take the work opportunity if you get it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because schools aren't going to go away. There's nothing going to shut the doors. I've had this conversation with my 20-year-old, and he's like, no, I'm not leaving school. I'm like, well, you're out of your mind.
We're such great influencers. Yeah, quit going to school. Play video games.
If it's the kind of school that is really, really going to teach you a lot of things that you wouldn't learn otherwise, if it's really going to shape you, then it's probably worth it. But I can count the things that I know that I may not have learned outside of school on one hand, compared to I would have run out of hands and toes very quickly if I wanted to count the things that I learned in a very short period of time professionally that it took me forever to pick up at art school because it was just such a low stakes, low speed way to learn it.
Yeah, and you have the trial by fire of the professional world. That will keep you going.
Oh yeah, man. When I started on Quake 4, they really threw me into the deep end. Once they actually hired me, I remember my level design lead, Jim Jersey Hughes, sat me down and he's like, hey, listen, this is the first thing we need from you. We had this multiplayer map. It was built for a texture set that got repainted, so it doesn't look right anymore. It's visually broken, so we just need someone to rebuild it, and we need that done by beta. I'm like, okay, cool. When's beta? He goes, Thursday. I'm like, all right, I guess I can do a whole map in 3 days. This was Tuesday, by the way. I just went straight into crunch mode. But I was eager to, like, I'm going to make this map great, and I did. It turned out pretty well. But that was my introduction in the first 2 days of what the people on that team had already been experiencing for like a year.
And so you were strictly on the multiplayer side of the design, or did you do any of the single player levels or work on any of those as well for Quake 4?
I covered a lot of single player bug fixing. That was all that was really being done on single player at that point in the project, was just get it fixed up enough to get out the door. But then once we shipped it and once we got the Xbox port working right, then we had time for the point release, which is always where traditionally, like the id Software games would throw in a few multiplayer maps in that first big patch. So me and Andrew Weldon, Kung Fu Squirrel, were sort of the tag team, just making a couple more extra multiplayer maps with the time we had left. And so that was where I think four of those maps came from.
So now, talking about Quake 4, how long, after development, did you kind of follow the multiplayer scene or anything? Because I thought for a brief little moment there in time and history, Quake 4 multiplayer was kind of a thing, and it kind of died out pretty quickly. But I started thinking about this podcast I heard from the Motherload a few weeks ago, and he was talking to like this pro Quake 4 player, you know, who traveled and played professional Quake 4, which kind of blew my mind. I didn't even know, I didn't really realize that was a thing. So how was your perception of the game and the community after its release?
There was a lot of anticipation about the next Quake, because it was sort of assumed that we would follow on from Quake World to Quake 3 to Quake 4. It was just going to be the next thing. And then when it came out and it was adequate. Like the multiplayer designers definitely did their best, but due to some of it was limitations in the tech and some of it was just limitations in the design, but it didn't wind up blowing everyone's socks off the way that the expectations were set with, another Quake game. So everyone kind of gradually decided, oh, well, there are other things I can play. And it didn't glue a whole audience together the way games like Quake World or Quake 3 did, which was, the whole game was, everything about Quake 4 was, that was sort of the outcome. It was adequate, but nothing that was really amazing to anyone.
What about being a fan of these games and kind of just as a consumer going to the development side, then does, having, I don't want to say a failure, but a disappointment that the game didn't live up to expectations or what have you. How does that make you feel as a, once you're on the development side?
It was a real learn how the sausage is made moment, because yeah, I came onto a team of a lot of the people on that team were, Raven hired a bunch of people from the mod scene, like people like us, they thought that was the best way forward for Quake. And it wound up being a lot of young guys who got really bitter when things didn't work out perfectly. And there was a lot of it was a difficult game to kind of push through, and that there were, not to speak too much out of school, but there were a lot of people who had creative veto power, but not a lot of people who actually did the creative work. So every idea had to run the gauntlet of like Raven management, and then id had to like it, and then Activision producers had to like it too. And then sometimes that probably involved Activision marketing also. And so once you have that many cooks putting salt in the soup, you know, no idea that doesn't offend anyone can get through. And so you wind up with a very safe game. The first time I visited Raven, I remember the story was that Jim was done talking to him, and he wanted to go find somebody else for me to talk to. And he said, just wait here. And I was standing in front of a wall of concept art that they had put up. And one piece of concept art was this giant grid of like dozens and dozens of permutations of the Quake 4 logo. What could it be? Every combination of the Q with like four nails in it in every direction, and with like the Strog wings and like all kinds of different iconography and gears, like everything you can think of. And I sat there going, oh, this one's pretty cool. And I kind of like this one. And I don't know, I'd be happy with that one. And the thing is, I think everybody that stood in front of that wall picked a different two or three logos out of the four or five dozen that were there. And I remember when we finally revealed the logo as part of the marketing in late beta, the first thing that the angry entitled internet said was, what? That's it? Because it was the logo that got past the committee.
I actually like that logo. And I actually did the contest. I did the Photoshop contest integrating the logo into the real world. I don't know if you remember that happening, but I was very, you know, very much anticipating the game. And I did this really creepy, crazy image that I will link to with my son looking down in the water and this kind of Quake 4 logo with the little Strug kind of bumps. and it was into the water. So it was basically like a jellyfish kind of thing. I'm not doing it justice explaining it, but, and I was so incensed that I didn't win, but, you know,
we'll need a link for that.
I really want to see this.
I will dig that up. I printed it out as a poster. I have it somewhere as a poster.
Something we all thought was really weird was that like at the time it was very vogue for publishers to kind of paint over screenshots, like do the bull shots, they were called, kind of like hide things that didn't look quite right and make the screenshots look a little bit better than the game actually does. And one of the strangest things they did is that everywhere where there was a Strog that had visible nipples, they photoshopped the nipples off. So all the like weird male aliens just had blank chests with no nipples.
That's pretty strange.
We couldn't figure out what the problem with them was. Like, if it was like ladies' nipples, yeah, we could understand that. But there's that weird kind of dichotomy of male nipples are okay. But as far as Activision marketing was concerned at the time, even male nipples were off. It was better to have a weird featureless chest. So that was one of the things that they actually paid marketing people to sit in Photoshop and take care of for us was male nipple removal.
What a great use of resources, right?
Yep.
So far, you're painting a picture of bureaucratic hell.
I don't want to make it sound that bad. Like, for the most part, it was a lot of fun. The people that I work with were great. Like, I don't want to make the Raven, like Quake 4 team sound like they were awful people at all. Cause we like, they became a core of friends that like I still talk to this day. Like there are still people that I work with professionally or on the side. Like I met Scampi through Raven did I get him hired there? I think that may be how it worked out. But, yeah, I still work with Andrew Weldon. Like I followed him to like two or three more jobs, and we worked on projects on the side just for fun because we got along really well together. And now a lot of them are out here in the Seattle area, so I see them all from time to time. So they were a great bunch of guys.
That does sound like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it was pretty cool too, coming from the mod community and having your compadres, you know, from the mod community be coworkers. You know, it's got to be cool. I was a giant fan of Raven, you know, from Heretic on basically. And Soldier of Fortune 3 holds a really, or I'm sorry, 2. Soldier of Fortune 2 holds a really dear place in my heart because that was the first game I was actually really good at. And then when I went back to playing, I mean, just multiplayer, you know, like I could play single player or whatever, but a game that I actually had skill and I enjoyed the gameplay and the mechanics and the physics and all that. And then when I went back to Quake 3, I was so much better because, you know, you had to aim down sights and not aim down sights, but you had to use different, different bullet spreads and things you had to account for that I just was never thinking of when I played Quake 3. So that when I went back and played Quake 3 a few times with some buddies, I was just nailing people, and it was all due to Soldier Fortune 2. But I even mapped for that game, fired up Radiant, and tried. I didn't do anything good, but
yeah, the Quake 3 engine was kind of a golden window for both me and for the industry, because it was such a workhorse engine. Like, it did what it did well, and it did it really, really fast. So you could pretty much throw anything that still looked good during that era at that engine, and it would handle it just fine. So it was really easy to crank out good games and good levels with it. It was a lot of fun.
So we should ask you about it. Now, you did other development, and I know you're not in development any longer, but what are some of the other experiences you had after Raven?
After Raven, I worked for a startup founded by some guys who had broken off a human head, and we never shipped anything before the company closed. That's a whole different story. Then from there, I freelanced for a while. I did some work for Natural Selection, just making environment props. I was debating when I left Raven. I wasn't sure if I wanted to continue down a level design track or go down the environment art path, because the way that we make maps for Quake is kind of it's a strange artifact, the way that you're sort of doing the environment art and the level design at the same time. There's very much like the fork was happening back then, back in like 2006-07, that was when I was really beginning to split between guys who were purely gameplay design and systems people, and the people who would do the art pass on the maps afterwards would be a completely different set of people from a different department. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay in level design, because at the time I already wasn't playing very many games anymore. And all my level design job interviews were like, "So what are you playing these days?" I'm like, "Oh, nothing." Like, that's already not a good sign if you're hiring a level designer who doesn't, if you're hiring a game designer who doesn't play games. But on the art side, like, I was much more interested in writing my own tools and experimenting with new methods. So I wound up kind of going that way. So I freelanced doing that for a while. And then eventually, Andrew Weldon wound up at a studio in Texas called Lightbox. And he said, "You should come down here. It's great here." I'm like, "All right." So I interviewed and talked to them about various different things. And by the end of the day, they said, you know, before I even left the interview, they're like, "We're going to make you an offer. So when, by the time you land, you should have an offer." And I'm like, "All right." So I wound up taking the offer, and I lived in Texas for a little while. And yeah, Lightbox was such a good place to work. Like, that was an even more tight knit group of people than the Quake 4 team was. Like, it was a real core of friends. And when Sony shut that studio down, do I really want to have to go try to find another job in the industry that's as good as this one was? Like, I know the next place I go to is probably just going to be another political rat's nest, or I'm going to be working on Barbie Horse Adventures 3, or it's going to be some such thing. And I was kind of torn. So I decided to take some time off, and I did my gap year travel thing for a while instead. And I picked the worst time to do that, because while I was doing that was the PS3 to PS4, like that console generation changeover. So by the time I came back after that year, everyone was using different tools. Like, kids coming out of school, new tools that I had never even used. I'm like, "Oh, geez, do I really want to sit and I got to build a new machine just to learn this stuff?" And I didn't feel that I really wanted to do that. So I decided I was pretty much done.
Interesting. I know the common thing is like, you're going to have like five different careers in your life. And was like, "Well, I've only had one, luckily," but it's really not that big of a deal. But you know, sometimes you kind of get to points in your life. Good for you for making that call, because I mean, it is a meat grinder. I mean, the industry to me, just as an observer, a casual observer, doesn't seem like it's getting any better. It seems like the stakes are higher with every, you know, kind of large AAA release, and you know, just, you know, destroys people, and people are constantly on the move trying to find a better position. So good for you for having the temerity to make the call for your mental health.
Well, thank you. I haven't figured out what I'm going to do instead yet, but I did leave out one thing from the work history, which was that in between, like after the travel time and the current, my current window of laziness, I worked with Davey Reedon on his Stanley Parable sequel, the Beginner's Guide.
Nice.
That was a really It was a fascinating project because I had never had to do anything remotely like that before, because his games are so meta. Like, he involves the audience in such a way that I wasn't just building maps for his game. I was having to role play the designer that I was supposed to be playing. Like, I was...
What?
Yeah, I had to get into the shoes of the character in the game who supposedly built the levels that I was building, that the user was playing. This is what his games are like. You've got to explain like three different layers of who everyone is and who the audience even is and who Davey even is before anyone even makes any sense. So it was like half level design and half art direction, but also half acting.
That's very cool.
Level design is already kind of a strange, it's already one degree of indirection, right? Like, you've got to communicate gameplay expectations to a player, but you've got to do it through architecture. And so to have to use that at another level of indirection to communicate like character motivation was really something else. And I doubt I'll ever get to work on anything quite like that again.
I can kind of see what you're trying to say, just from my limited knowledge of, you know, Quake mapping and Doom mapping. It's like, when someone's playing your map in single player, they're not fighting the monsters necessarily. They're fighting, the level designer's intent with the monsters.
Yes.
Or, you know, or just however the encounters are arranged, however the architecture is set up. So, you know, when you play a map that you've made, for example, it's me versus you, but you're the guy who made the map. Kind of like a dungeon master in D&D, sort of.
That's exactly that is just the metaphor I was about to use. You're right on. Something that I've said before is that there's no such thing as single player. Even if you're playing Minecraft where everything is totally generated, it's still generated by algorithms that are informed by things that the person who created Minecraft tuned for certain reasons, to make certain discoveries feel more serendipitous and to make the environment conducive to certain things. So even then, there's always somebody that you're sort of playing with who is there. And Quake level design and Doom level design are great examples of how much that is true, because the id guys played a lot of D&D, and so their level design was very much informed by laying out dungeons on paper, on big sheets of paper on tabletops for each other to go play through. And yeah, when you plan a dungeon like that, you sort of have to be of two minds. There's the person you are ahead of time when you're planning what your players are going to do, and when you're that person, you're trying to choose the right level of challenge, and you're trying to like scare them and establish some tension, but not so much that you're being unfair to them. But then once you actually sit down at the table to run the encounter, all bets are off because the monsters aren't going to pull any punches. And so you at that point are playing as the monsters. So you can't pull any punches either, or they're going to feel like you're going easy on them. And then all the tension that you tried to create in the first phase kind of evaporates in the second phase. And when you make Quake maps, you don't really have to be that second designer so much, because the AI just does that for you, AI or lack thereof. Yeah. So you pretty much just have to focus on phase one, where what is the right level of challenge, the right level of resources, the right level of manageable cruelty that I can inflict on the player before they start to feel like it's genuinely unfair.
That's funny you guys brought up D&D. You know, when you turn, like, I'm 51, and so there are thoughts that you think and memories that you have that go away. And then when something says something like that, you remember, oh yeah, because when I used to explain people why I made Doom maps and Quake levels, the first thing I would say is, it's like making a dungeon in Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
Because I used to do that. So thank you for bringing those memories back. But I wanted to jump to, you know, because we're like 27 minutes in and we're going to get skewered here if we don't start talking about your most recent accomplishment.
Oh, yeah.
Something very huge, and this, just get ready to get on the hyperbole train right now, because JCR and I are both
huge.
Huge fans of Copper. I was so excited. I was just telling JCR, I was sitting there reading the website is a joy, let alone playing the mod. But you really explained everything and your reasoning. And it truly shows how committed you are to Quake 1. And, you know, we love the game and we're here because we love the game. But you have gone next level in my book. You know, so talk about how Copper got started, and just walk us through, and then I'm sure we'll pop in with some questions.
Well, first of all, thank you. I'm glad you had so much fun with it. Copper kind of grew out of LUN-SP2, which is still not done and may never be done. That kind of grew out of LUN-SP1, which my main problem with that was that the boss fight just made absolutely no sense to anyone. It was terrible. So I'm like, I'm not going to make that mistake again. So I began, that was my lesson of I should pay a lot more attention to design. And I've been paying so much attention to design that LUN-SP2 still isn't done. But as I worked on it, there were lots of little things that I started to feel kind of friction with in Quake's design. Like, I don't ever really want to use this monster because you can only use it this way, or you can only put it here. And I don't ever want to give the player a red armor because the way the math works out, the player is basically invulnerable for as long as he can make it last, which is potentially forever. So do I really want to start changing these things alongside all the stuff that I'm adding to LUN-SP2? Because that'll make the payload of the mod kind of a huge thing if people have to relearn all of this new gameplay at the same time that they're learning the stuff that I've added as a part of that mod. And so the idea began to grow that, well, maybe I can just take those changes and port them off to sort of siphon them into their own thing with no new content, like just the tweaks. And then I can make some maps for that, and I can get out of the rut that I'm kind of in with the level design for LUN-SP2, because everything is so planned and structured at this point that I just don't have a whole lot of fun building stuff for that anymore. And I wanted to just sort of get back to the joy of making little nonlinear fun spaces where you just kind of roam around and find keys and have ambushes and have just sort of rediscover the joy of mapping. And since I had already been kind of working on rewriting QuakeEd also, it was a good opportunity to also sort of stress test my own editor so that I wasn't just testing a feature for 3 minutes and going, oh, it works fine, and then closing the debugger and forgetting about it. So there were a lot of reasons why it all just kind of came together. Like, well, I think now is the time to sort of make this mod. So over the last I started in October or November. Over the last 8 months now, I've just been sort of working on this on Copper. So yeah, it all kind of came together as a way of solving a couple of different problems for me.
So give us the elevator pitch for Copper for people who may not have played it yet.
The elevator pitch for Copper is that Quake came out 23 years ago, and we've all learned a lot about game design since then. We've all gotten better at playing games like Quake since then. You know, 3D isn't a new thing that scares us. And also, Quake wasn't really as finished as it could have been when they shipped it. They had worked real hard on the tech, and they had thrown a lot of content away, and they were kind of burned out. And there was some internal stress at the studio with, you know, personal politics. You can read the book for that. But when Quake came out, everyone thought it was the greatest new thing because it was. But at the same time, it probably could have been a little better if they had baked it for maybe 2 or 3 more months. And so my thought was, well, what would they have done? And we sort of know what they would have done because Quake 2 came out shortly thereafter. But the thing that it seems like Quake itself was trying to be, even though it wasn't really what anyone at the studio themselves may have wanted, like Romero wanted something that was much more like what he eventually turned into Daikatana. And, you know, other people wanted something that was a little bit more like Doom, and it became this kind of weird half measure thing in between. And we've all since then kind of found this real identity that's there in Quake of what it wound up turning out that itself wants to be. And I sort of wanted to explore what... This is a long elevator ride. I'm sorry.
We're in a very tall building.
We're going up the Dubai. But so to cut a long story short, I just wanted to apply a little bit of polish to Quake in a modern design context without going very next-gen on the rails, making it too easy. I wanted to sort of polish that high-level gameplay that is sort of there and bring it out a little more, make Quake a little bit more like Quake.
And I mean, for those of you listening who have not played it yet, it was my experience that the changes introduced are subtle, they're thoughtful, and they actually bring something to the table that is real. I don't know how to describe. They were subtle, and I mean, it's just the right changes, I think, because when I played through it, it was like I was playing Quake for the first time. And I remember I told you that over Discord. Yeah. It was like a brand new experience, but it was the same Quake. So all of those friction points, like how the Shambler is not a fun monster to fight over and over again. You know, that was one thing that was kind of corrected. Did little changes to the enforcers. And I mean, all those little things add up to be something better than just any individual singular change, I think.
I had to be very careful because I knew that there were a lot of people who liked Quake the way that it was. And even the things that sort of seem like are wrong with Quake are things that people are kind of attached to. Like, you can have the argument, are spawns broken? Well, it kind of, maybe. Like, if they hadn't shipped in the game and I added them the way that they are in, you know, stock Quake, and you played it for 5 minutes, you go, oh God, no, those are terrible. I take that out. Exactly. But because they were in the game and they shipped, we came to them with a different mindset of this is a finished game. They did it on purpose. So take it at face value. And the face value of spawns is that, I think CCG once said that at the end of the map, when you have all the weapons and you're on top of the world, the only monster that the player is still afraid of is the spawn, because they're just so unpredictable. They're so frightening. And I knew that fixing the spawn, if there's anything to do to them at all, couldn't in any way blunt that edge. Like, they still had to be this crazy pinball rocket around the level that could kill you at any time. So all I really did instead was add sort of a soft counter for if you really, really can't manage it, you can just back off and things kind of calm down again. It's not an endless crapshoot.
Yeah, I just played a map last week. I think it was a speed map. I can't remember the pack, the name of the level, but I played a map where two spawns came out and they missed me and they went, they kind of fell and dropped down to a lower section of the level. And so I'm hearing this, you know, that sound over and over, like as I'm traversing, because there's a little bit of backtracking in the map, and I'm like, God, where are those guys? Why can't they find me? It would be a lot more terrifying to play that in Copper, because then they're just creeping down there, and I don't know exactly where they landed and everything. So I'm gonna have to go back and try that. But yeah, these things are cumulative, and I have not played any of the original id maps. I've only played the included Underdark Overbright, I think.
Yes.
So, and I'm still not finished with it, by the way. But yeah, enjoyable. I can't wait to play the original game and some of the suggested maps that you list in the README. And one thing I want to tell people that, you know, especially mappers, you know, you've got an FGD and a def file, you've got source code. You could integrate this into your mod, or, you know, there's a right way to do it. And please read the README. But yeah, I think this is going to track. I think this is going to be enjoyed for some time to come, because just the changes you made to the nail gun and the Hell Knights, I'm just like over the moon. I'm just, it's
totally
so,
agree.
Yeah, I mean, it's great stuff. Well thought out.
It's funny, JCR, when you played the beta, like that pre-release I sent you, and you were like, oh, Hell Knight projectiles are faster. I like that. I'm like, no, they're not. I didn't change that. That's funny. He's imagining things. And then I told that to Scampi, and he goes, no, I think you did. And he looked in the code for me and said, look, you changed this number. I'm like, oh, shit, I did that. And I must have done that possibly. It could have been like 8 years ago that I did that and just forgot about it and got used to it. So that sort of torpedoes a hole in the side of my whole, well, the speed of projectiles is very important because players notice every little change. And if you change those between skill levels, they'll notice. And here I had done it myself and not even noticed going back to id. So that's sort of on me that I made that mistake. But then because he pointed that out and because you pointed that out, I went back and evaluated, well, did I pick the right number? And I decided that I didn't really... I don't think that I had that I picked. It went from 300 to 500, and that was just, I felt that was too fast. So I dialed it back to 425 specifically because it's only a little bit faster than you can move. So it gives you just enough time to either back away or back to the side. So it's all about looking for little overlaps in the rules, places where these two numbers are kind of the same, little synergies in the design where you can discover little things like that that you can use to your advantage. The fact
well,
that
that's an interesting point. Sorry to interrupt you.
Hey, that's fine.
But you mentioned there that 500 was too fast, and I really liked it like that. So I was like, ah, yeah, it was perfect. Just leave it alone. It was great. I love that the Hell Knights are a threat now. But then you just described how that's faster than the player can move, so you don't have an opportunity to dodge. And it's like that level of thought, you know, that went right over my head. But now you're explaining it, it's like, oh, you know, that degree of thoughtfulness is what makes all of your changes very tasteful.
JCR, you're a very high skill player. Like,
yeah, you know, not a big deal.
Yeah, but the fact that you still find it playable when the projectiles are too fast to maneuver around is because you have already learned enough about positioning and enough about predicting what the monsters are doing to always be in the right place anyway, so that it never really comes up. And something I found myself having to do was find avenues for changes in the design that were both providing a little more challenge for people at the high end, but also not so much more that I was cutting people out of the middle. Like, there were some things that I had done that made normal skill worse for normal skill players that I didn't really realize at first, that once I went to the playtest, some people, guys who were normally used to playing on normal skill, were saying, these things all just got way worse. Like, one of the things that Vorballs, I had accidentally made them do, was that they have a fast turn mode and a slow turn mode. And when you kill the Vorb, they go into slow turn mode. But another trigger for slow turn mode was you being out of line of sight. And what that did is that if you hid, it would stop turning so fast and it would wind up going around the corner even more often than it used to. So it was actually more vicious about following you around the map if you were trying to play the old way, where you just sort of back up and go around into cover. If you were playing it the new way, where you just sidestep and you do the quick move, then it was much easier for you. But if you did it the old way, if you were used to fighting Vors and you were relying on your old instincts, then it was actually more difficult. And I'm like, well, I need to fix this. So I just commented that line out. And so now they track you at the same rate, whether or not you're in view. So it's a lot easier to still lead them into corners the way you used to be able to, which was, I'm glad I figured that out before I shipped, because I wouldn't have wanted to make something worse in a way that it excluded people from Quake. I didn't want people to go, oh, well, this mod isn't for me. I wanted to make sure that it was for as many people as possible, which is getting back to the fact that so many people play Quake so many different ways. I didn't want to make sure that I wanted to make sure I wasn't stepping on any toes, on anything that people were attached to. I wanted to make sure that everyone could feel and agree that this was a mod for them and not for someone else.
Now, you touched on armor, the red armor before, and then I just want to say, you know, I don't think it's a big surprise to people who listen to this podcast that I am supremely math challenged. And you kind of confuse Metal Slime, and he's not math challenged. So can you explain the changes to the armor system for someone like me who reread that section in your readme a couple times and went,
Yeah, I'll explain the old armor system first. There's three different colors of armor. And each one has a degree of protection associated with it. And if you pick up a green one, it absorbs like 30% of damage. Like, and any damage you take, 30% of it goes into your armor hit points, and the other 70 goes into your health hit points. And then a yellow is 60%, so it's above the halfway mark. And then red is 80%. So if you pick up a red armor, you've got 200 armor, and if you've got 100 health, then if you take 100 damage, then 80 of those points go into your armor and only 20 go into your health. So you go down to 120-80. If you take 200 damage, which is enough to kill an unarmored player twice, you're still at 40 armor and 60 health. And after 250, that's enough to lose your armor, but you're still only at 50 health. So as long as you have red armor, you basically can't die. And I just felt that when I would place red armors, I wanted to be able to give those as a cool reward. But at the same time, I knew that if I did that, I was just going to destroy the game balance for a lot longer than I wanted to for the reward of finding one secret area. So I knew that I kind of wanted something that would address that for me without feeling like I was taking too much away from players. And so the new system is that when you're in the 150 to 200 range that is, you know, the difference between yellow and red, you get that red level protection. But then once you drop down below 150, it's scaled down to yellow level protection. And then once you've dropped down below 100, it's down to green level protection. So one armor kind of degrades into another one.
Right. So it's the proportions that are changing. Okay, I get it now.
Plus, when you pick up the armor, you know, you could have, if you've got like 60 yellow armor and you find a green armor, do you want it? like, I don't know, is it better or not? It's more armor points, but the protection isn't as strong. So like, you've got to do this weird mental decision of like, it's not really based on anything other than how you feel. And even if you touch it, you don't know if you can pick it up or not until you try, because there's some, like the progs did some calculation where it would like multiply each amount by the protection strength or divide one by the other and see which one. It seems kind of arbitrary, and you know, it didn't help you make the decision of, is this an item worth picking up or not? But if it just degrades in a linear fashion, then you only have to worry about, is it more than what I have or not, which is exactly the way all the other pickups work. Am I going to pick up, if I pick up this ammo, will I waste it because I don't need as much as in the box? You know, do I pass the marshmallow test of coming back and getting 40 shells later because I didn't pick up 20 now? You know, it is more in line with the other items, which is a little more intuitive.
Right. Makes sense. One thing I will ask, what was the hardest element to work on? I know you posted about some AI stuff that you tried, but what was one of the more challenging things to nail and get right?
I remember sassing Vorbals for a while. Like I tried a lot of different things, and I was tuning like the exact amount of degrees that it turned per second I was just like fiddling that dial for a while until I hit on something that I felt was really, that felt right in a lot of cases. It was just a lot of like loading, you know, vor.testmap and just letting them throw things at me and dodging them and seeing how it worked, and then going through some of the episode 4 maps and see if it still felt that way in application. And I spent a long time just on vors to make sure that it was something that really, really felt like it was going down the center of the alley and not straying off too far one side or the other. There were things that I probably would have liked to have done if this were just, you know, Matt's Quake mod and not something that was positioned the way that Copper was going to be positioned as an id1 replacement that everyone can find something to like about. I had experimented with the shotguns, something that a couple of people have done in their own mods, is make them slower and more powerful, which is something that I kind of like. The way that I love the Doom 2, the double shotgun, for the fact that it feels like when you fire it, it's an event, like it's a decision that you make. And every time you fire it, something about the battlefield kind of changes. Either you're just knocking off a big chunk of one big monster, or you kill a bunch of small ones at once, or it's you. Yeah, there's a big decision to make every time you fire, and you have like a second and a half to make that decision, which in a game like Doom is a long time. And so I tried that in Quake. I fiddled with the exact amounts of how many more pellets a shotgun would fire and how long I would wait. And I settled on, I think, a difference of about like 60%, because I found that there were a lot of nice little synergies in the amount of health that different monsters had and the amount of damage that the shotguns would do that would make it feel like for example, ogres were 3 double shotgun shots, but you could be kind of sloppy with them. But Hell Knights were also 3, but you had to be really precise. You had to get in real close and get like, make sure you got all the pellets in, or else you would have to spill over into a fourth shot. And it worked out in a lot of ways really well, but ultimately I just felt like this feels like it's not, it feels more like it's my weapons mod and not like it's just Quake made a little bit better. So I wound up just taking it all out.
Now, you did make a change to the shotguns though.
I changed the way the pellets interact with monsters when you hit them, because when they die, they become take damage no, which means that they're effectively solid walls for a couple of frames before they become non-solid. And you've probably noticed like in gameplay when you're firing at a guy with a nail gun, as soon as he dies, the last couple of nails you shoot, like they'll do the gray puff, they'll plink against him instead of just going through or damaging him even more.
Yeah. And
the Arcane Dimension solution to that was just let them take damage the entire time, which is the origin of how it feels like you can jib everything with a nail gun, because you can just add up damage on a guy until his body falls apart. And that to me made jibbing feel kind of not special. And so I wanted a different solution. And the one, basically the way Doom worked already felt pretty well to me. I sort of treated Doom as almost like legal precedent. So I tried it working that way, and I had to do a lot of work with the trace code to get it to function correctly in all cases. But instead of just letting it do more damage, it meant you were doing potentially more damage, but in situations where you had to pay attention to your positioning. So that was one more thing that worked out, in the sense that it was something that provided another skill-based avenue for people who wanted to play at a really high level and really get good at the game, and something that wouldn't be taken away from players at a lower level. Because if you just fire the guns, they still feel like they work the same as before. But if you're really attention to, I am shooting through this guy at that guy, it gives you a little, gives you one more thing to kind of use and think about as you're playing.
It's and another it's, like layer of, it's another dimension of, or like it, what you're doing there is you're almost adding more depth, because now your positioning matters in a different way that it didn't before.
Right, and it's not excessive either, because you're calculating the trace of each of the pellets that are passing through the dead monster, or they're just explain how that works code wise.
In Stockquake code wise, you fire the shotgun, it does one trace for every pellet, and because of there's this thing called multi damage. You've seen that in the progs where it starts adding up damage. One pellet at a time, and then when the whole shotgun firing sequence is over, it adds it all up and then applies it. And what happens there is that if you add up more damage than it takes to kill a guy, then all the extra is just sort of not quite wasted, but it gets applied to the guy anyway. So that's the origin of being able to jib a guy with a shotgun. You just sort of get him really close to the line, and then the last shot is enough to spill over. But then every one of those pellets is still kind of wasted on the guy that you just hit. And the way that it works in Doom is that they don't combine the pellets. It just does one at a time. And as soon as a guy dies, he becomes non-solid, and then it goes back to finishing the rest of the pellets. So they all go through to the next guy. So it was a matter of, A, getting guys to behave in a way that is not solid to traces, but is still solid to players. So you don't get to walk through guys and see the inside of the model briefly before they fall over. But also, I didn't want to make Quake's shotgun jibbing go away, because people are kind of attached to that too, and I didn't want to take that away. So the way it works instead is you hit a guy with a trace, it does the damage, or it checks if he's close enough to death to be killed by the damage. And if it is, it still gives him some, just a little bit less. And then it just does the trace again, starting from that point and ignoring that guy and just looking for someone behind him. And you can, it'll loop through as many guys as you hit. If you have them all lined up, a bunch of guys with low health, you can potentially shoot through them all, like Indiana Jones style.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very much the same thing as Doom, which was one of the things that made the shotgun in that game so special. And you know, like, maybe it's just me, but I feel like the where you stand on the Doom 2 shotgun, whether you love it or hate it, that's kind of almost like a religious, like, question, you know?
Who hates it?
Yeah, well, okay, yeah, you're one of us, see? Like, it's great, you know? If someone has a problem with the Doom 2 shotgun, it's kind of hard to be friends with you.
Are there people who are like that? Or, like, I don't have my fingers on the pulse of the Doom 2 shotgun community, so I don't really know exactly whether or not there are two camps or not. Is that true, or are you just...
I guess I wouldn't really know. But that's how I feel. That's just, you know.
We're all on the same page then, yeah.
The reception to Copper has been kind of positive. I mean, I know it's early days, but any kind of changes, any kind of things that you didn't foresee? Because that's one thing with mapping for me is, like, you think you've played it. Okay, well, how's this person going to play it? How's this person play it? And then you find out, oh, yeah, that's nothing I anticipated. Have you, anything surprised you about the response so far?
The one thing on my to-do list that I left off because I didn't think it would be a problem was new backpack pickup sounds. But I had just taken the ones from Arcane Dimensions, and nobody complained about them then. And then the one thing everyone in the Funk thread is saying is, God, that backpack pickup sound is just so terrible. How could you do that? I'm like, I guess I should have hit that last item on the list, I guess. So if I do ever push a patch for it, I guess I'll have to replace that sound if it bothers that many people. But
Listen, I posted about that actually myself, and I realized I play in Mark V, and it's a little hotter in Mark V than it would be in other source ports.
The sound, it sounds okay to me, because a lot of Quake is full of these really, really big sounds, like really strong, rich noises. Like everything, every waveform is just maximized if you look at them in the editor. And so that pickup sound is the same way. I thought Simon did a good job on it, but I mean, if a lot of people don't like it, then even if I'm okay with it, I should probably accept the fact that maybe there's something about it that I'm not hearing, and I should consider that. So, yeah, I'm not gonna start a fight over it if a lot of people hate it. I think if I got rid of it and did a better one, nobody who likes the current one would be upset to have it gone, so it seems like that's a worthwhile change to make.
Yeah, it seems like a very small, minor nitpick amongst just what is a golden mod, or should we say copper?
It's copper.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a... This is an interesting point, but around January, I was having conversations with people like Bale and Scampi about, what do I call this thing? Because I didn't... this is going to sound like I'm directing it at a certain person. I'm not, but I wanted to make sure that I didn't give the mod a name like Quake 1.5 or Quake, you know, second edition or something like that. I didn't want to give the mod a name that sounded like it was being too prescriptive. Like, I didn't want to sound like I was trafficking in names that didn't really belong to me, because people have kind of, you know, there's a sense of collective ownership in the Quake community. And if somebody comes out and says, my new thing is what Quake is, I didn't really want to go there. And my instincts were confirmed, because shortly thereafter, Bloodshot released Quake 1.5, and everyone gave him a bunch of flack specifically for the name. And I think it was because he may have just underestimated that a lot of people feel like Quake also belongs to them. So by saying these things that are, here are the things that I would add to Quake, and I think it would add them to Quake, but we can't really know, but this is, you know, here's my mod, please enjoy. And everyone, you know, anybody who likes the mod. And if it's not your cup of tea, then it's, you know, nobody's upset about that. But it's, I think the sense of taking the name for yourself is what people had a problem with. So I was glad that I had the thoughts that I had, because it turned out to be true, not 1 month later. So I was trying to think of a name of, you know, do I pick, so I should pick something from Quake, but RuneQuake is taken. Well, you got silver and gold keys, but calling it the silver or gold Quake is, that also seems to be prescriptive in a way that says, well, this is, it's got its own sense of quality. It sounds like I'm trying to sell it to you. And I didn't really want to do that. The name I had sort of as a prototype was like Chocolate Doom or Fitzquake. Like, those are things that people consider indispensable, but they don't have indispensable sounding names. Those are just things that they've earned the title of indispensable just on their own merits. And I wanted to make sure that I kept on that side of the fence. So I thought, well, how about copper? It's valuable for its utility, but not for ornamentation. It gets shiny when you polish it, and it's brown. So, you know, there you go.
Like
it's
Quake.
Wrong name. They were like Quake. So there you go.
And well, I feel like those names, are kind of like the names that you're referring to are almost like authoritative. It's like, this is Quake or something. I think that's kind of what you're trying to explain.
Yeah, I didn't want to give it a name that sounded like it was selling itself, because I personally really don't like selling myself. I like to just say, I just made this thing, and if you like it, you like it. I'm not going to do a lot of, you know, PR and marketing to try to change your mind. You are a grown up. You can make your own decisions. You don't need me to, like, try to change your mind by putting on a show and advertising to you. So... yeah, that was meant to be a hands-off name.
It's also, I'm sure there's a marketing term, but I work in marketing, I should know this already, but it's also basically a household word. I mean, it has meaning, but you're giving it a new meaning. It's, you know, once you hear Chocolate Doom, it's impossible to forget the name of it.
Yeah.
You know, like GZ, Z Doom, Basket Doom, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a common word that everyone knows, or most everyone knows, it's going to stick like that, you know? And so, you know, I think it's a good call. I think it's cool. I mean, Arcane Dimensions it's very descriptive and kind of sets a mood, but copper, I think you'll know it once you play this thing, you're going to know a copper, you know, you're going to know the mod and what it feels like right away. So the name is pretty arbitrary.
Yeah. If people liked it, then they would bring the association of it being good to the name. Like, they would make the word copper mean that without me having to do it for them.
Right. Exactly. Well, let me switch gears here. Just a quick little thing. You mentioned it earlier, Quake Ed. You brought that back, or it's kind of been, it's never gone away, really. But you've modernized that. You've made it run on modern machines. And I remember when you posted about it on Funk Message Board, I was really excited because I worked with, you know, that early version of Radiant that Duffy released years ago. And it is nice to go back to it. And it, just talk about, you know, that project and why that came about.
It came about because I'm a control freak, and Trench Broom is great, but I I've been using Radiant for so long. I don't know. I'm just sort of stuck in my ways. So in my warped mind, it was easier for me to start writing my own editor than just learn a different one. But I wanted to, you know, pick up some programming anyway. I wanted to do more serious, like C and C++ work. So I found the source for Sickpin had done a branch of QuakeEd 3 a couple of years ago, maybe like 6 or 7 years ago now, that I had been using, but I kept running up against the same bugs, and I finally decided I wanted to fix them all. So I started fixing that, and then I kept finding things to change and finding things to add, and I've eventually rewritten like half of it and doubled the size of the code base with new features. And yeah, it's kind of grown and evolved into almost like my own private editor that just has all the things that I like in it.
I loved messing around with it. I'm going to challenge myself to make a map using it, just for old time's sake, that kind of thing. Because I've fired up Dark Gradient and a lot of the major branches and things. And yeah, I'm stuck on Trench Broom, obviously. But I came from that world, and Trench Broom feels like QuakeEd to me. You know what I mean? Sleep actually said, That's by design, because he used Radiant as well. So that was one of the original kind of jumping off points, mode switching and things like that, between the 2D views and everything. But just obviously starting from a 3D perspective, first off, I like Trench Broom because it's an active development. There's a community. It's fun, you know, but I do still appreciate what you're doing with QuakeEd. So keep those updates coming, because I'm going to make a map in that sucker.
I have dug myself kind of a hole in that. The reason that I'm not using GTK Radiant is that a long time ago, I was really, really mouthy online about how much I didn't like GTK. And I never really cared for GTK either way. But I used to be very vocal about it in kind of a toxic smartass way. And now that I've worked on QuakeEd myself, basically the same code base for a while, I'm really feeling the limitations of Win32, and I've got to replace it with something, and I want it to be portable, and I don't want it to be GTK, but I also have to kind of eat my own dog food, in a sense. I got to eat my own words. Like, I've got to pick something. Do I use WX widgets? Because that's what they use for Trench Broom, and Eric and Sleep have both said that they don't like it, and they're moving away from it. So, I don't know. I've painted myself into a corner with how vocal I used to be about it, and now encountering, oh yeah, I see actually why they did that. Maybe I shouldn't have been such a loudmouth about it.
I'll live and learn, you know.
Yep.
It must be awesome to like have like a custom tool that you pretty much have customized to your own liking. How much more effective can you be than with a tool that you've customized for yourself to accomplish a task like mapping?
Every time I find myself doing something repetitive, I'm like, I bet I could just automate this as a tool. And then I'll stop mapping for a couple of days and write it up as a feature. And then, yeah, go back to mapping and using this new thing. And then I'll, genuinely put it to the test of, is this actually making me faster or not? So there's a GIF of a poly tool that I wrote where you just sort of almost Doom style, you just draw an outline of point to point to point. And then when you're done, it splits up the shape in a sensible way and makes brushes out of it. And I use that a lot for doing that narrow trim that's always around the edge of everything. You got to have that 16 unit band of, flat metal at the edge of the floor texture. So you've got a lip there. I would find myself spending so much time just doing the same, like cut off the 45 degree corner and then align the texture on the top and then do the next one and make the corners line up. And the 2-to-1 ratio is always the same on the diagonals. I'm like, I could just make a tool do this. So it was predictable enough that I could just automate it. So I made myself that little thing, and I'd use it all the time. So that is the one feature that QuakeEd has that Trench Broom does not yet have. Everything else that I've done has just been me seeing something new in Trench Broom and going, oh yeah, I should probably have that. And then challenging myself to match what Sleepwalker has implemented.
The Lunar trim tool, all rights reserved.
I was going to say, not, I'm going to sound like a fanboy here, but let's go down the list. You graduated from art school.
Yeah.
Bad, bad, bad boy. You can make hella great levels, multiplayer and single player. You got an amazing mod. It must have been a tremendous amount of work, and you do your own tools. Is there anything you don't do?
I can't sing.
Good. Okay. That's
one. I can't dance. I can't jump very high. I can't drive stick very well. I can sort of drive stick, but not very well. Yeah.
You just made me feel so much better because I can do almost all those things except for dance.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat with Lunarin.
So now I liked asking this question. So what's next? Is there, obviously you kept the lid on that copper pot for a long time. Do you have anything you haven't done that you're kind of ready to jump into besides Loon SP2?
I got to take some time on away from the computer stuff. I've got a motorcycle in the garage that I haven't ridden in far too long, and I've probably ruined the gas tank by letting it sit there for too long. So I've probably got some work to do there. But yeah, I've been sitting in front of Quake for such a long time now that I feel like it's probably a good window for a bit of a break.
Well, I think we're seeing a really big resurgence in Quake, and it just seems to keep snowballing. And every week there's something new, and there's new people coming in, and something like Copper is going to, you know, activate a lot more people. So it's just going to keep getting better. So when you come back after a break, it should be pretty cool. It's never going away. I mean, it just turned, what, 23?
Yeah.
23?
Yeah. Yesterday. 23.
Crazy.
Yeah, I hope so. Arcane Dimensions brought a lot of people in, and Trench Broom brought a lot of people in, and your videos brought a lot of people in. So yeah, where there's hopefully, I can only hope that Copper will do the same thing to bring even more people in.
You know, I've said this before, but it's like there is a Quake Renaissance going on.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's kind of true.
It comes in fits and starts every few years, and usually based around either a source port or tools, or now, you know, as you just mentioned, mods, things like Quake 1.5. I posted on Reddit, you know, because I have a kind of a little kind of circuit that I do whenever I post links, and I took the, you know, the what am I trying to say? I took the initiative and posted about Copper on Reddit for you.
Oh,
and you know, because there's an audience there. There's like 5,000 subs on the Quake subreddit, so I figured it's not a bad place to go drum up things. But I always see people asking, "Does it work?" You know, with Quake 1.5, and it just makes me nuts. So I actually put that in the post. No, this does not work with Quake 1.5.
Yeah, that's the thing not everyone understands is that mods are basically mutually exclusive, yes, and there's exactly. No way to really combine them. So yeah, that's unfortunate, yeah. But. Yeah, 1.5 is another one that probably belongs in the list along with AD and Trench Broom and everything else for bringing in a new wave of people, because one of the things that may have turned off people about Quake is the fact that it's just not as big and bombastic as games are used to playing nowadays. You know, they can play the new Doom and have punch guys' heads off, or they can go play Brutal Doom and have, you know, gore and explosions and blood everywhere, but there was never really anything for Quake. So Bloodshot totally kind of filled a niche with that.
Yeah. And he's, you know, also there's the things that don't get mentioned about Bloodshot. He's an incredible level designer. Like, just so his stuff is so solid.
And it's brilliant stuff. Yep.
Yeah, that's all over Quake 1.5 as well. And I think that kind of gets forgotten that there's some really, really nice design and beautiful environments that he's created. So, it's all good, man. There's so many good things happening in the scene. I'm, you know, earlier this week I saw, I think it was Ionis and Skaki playing multiplayer, which is like, yeah, cool, man. This is like something I haven't seen in a long time or ever.
So it's all in good fun. At the end of the day, it's all about fun. We're playing games here.
No, exactly. But what I'm saying is, like, there was a fracture. You know, there was a kind of a separation between single player content creators and multiplayer, you know.
Oh, yeah, I gotcha.
And I love seeing the overlap, and it's only going to get better. So,
indeed it is.
Yeah. Can't wait.
Well, promise us you'll come back when you have something new to celebrate, whether it's next week or next year. Please, please do.
I'll probably be back. It's a very comfortable kind of, Quake is like an old shoe, you know, it's just, you put it on and it's comfy, and you can, even though the tongue is kind of flapping on it, you can still, you know, walk 100 miles in it and just, your feet feel fine.
That's right. Great way to put it. That's it for this episode of the Quakecast. Before we sign off, JCR, where can people find you?
You could search YouTube for JCR9001 and twitch.tv/JCR9001.
And you can find me on YouTube as well. Just search for dumptruck_DS.